ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When energy costs jump, everyone feels it. At the Bowser, on the power bill, and across the economy.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. On ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we break down the latest in fuel, energy, and the forces driving prices.
It's a quick, clear update on what's moving, why it matters, and what it can mean for your wallet and the wider economy.
Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. I'm officially back from a family camping trip where I was fortunate enough to be without internet, so I had the opportunity to relax and check out of the world and the news for a few days. That being said, every time anyone arrived at the campsite from the outside world, I kind of grabbed them by the collar and demanded updates on what was going on in Iran, so perhaps I wasn't as disconnected as I should have been. When I surfaced properly and returned to the basement, I was not all that surprised to find out that ceasefire negotiations in the US-Iran war had started, happened, and fallen apart again. Also, the US president is criticizing not only NATO, but also the Pope, apparently.
I don't think he's doing a very good job. He likes crime, I guess.
Now, supervising producer Kara Jensen-McKinnon also had a short break, but she's been back longer than I have and has been spending that time getting up to speed with exactly what's happened with these US-Iran negotiations, and she's going to tell me sort of the TikTok, the rundown on what happened. We've also got a bunch of great questions about the war that you've sent through to our email, if you're listening at abc.net.au, which we will answer for you today. G'day, Kara.
Hello. How's it going? Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back. The camping was interesting. We went up in our minivan because there are six of us, and you have to use diesel-powered engines still to transport six people and all the camping equipment at once. So on the way up to camping, we had the kids' bikes strapped onto the roof, and we were doing 8.9 litres of diesel per 100 kilometres from Newcastle up to Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the way back, we didn't have the bikes on the top and we were doing 7.1 litres per 100 kilometres. It made a significant difference to fuel efficiency. So that's my tip. Do you have any hot tips on fuel efficiency that you picked up from your time off, Kara?
God.
You got married, was there?
I got married.
Well, what was the wedding car? What was the wedding car powered by?
There was no... Well, we had the official, so we had a wedding on the Saturday, but we had our official legal ceremony on the Friday, and I wanted to get married outside on a lookout, but a cyclone that was brewing had other plans, and so we kind of stood there as the eye of the storm passed over us and got completely saturated, which was like funny and romantic. But then when it came to all of the legal signing of the paperwork, we had to do it in my very small car. So my brother, my sister-in-law, the celebrant, me, and my new husband all got into the car and signed all of the paperwork in there as it was pouring.
Is what you're telling me that you legally got married inside like a Camry or something?
Well, it was a Yaris, if I'm allowed to say. And so we're calling it our Yarage.
Oh,
we're happily ever Yarried.
Oh, that's very congrats. Congratulations, Kara, on your Yarage.
But the Yaris, it is very fuel efficient. I could speak for a long time about the fuel efficiency of a Yaris, but I won't because I'm probably not allowed to.
Let's pivot from the delight and the joy of your marriage to the conflict in the Middle East.
Yes.
There's really no elegant way of doing that. So you've been having a look at exactly what happened over the weekend with JD Vance in Pakistan. Tell me about it because I didn't follow it very closely.
If we go back all the way back to Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of days earlier, a US Air Force plane had been shot down, and there was a particularly excellent article in the New York Times detailing the rescue mission of the pilot, which would have been, this entire mission would have been an absolute win for Trump.
Mm.
But on the same day, this is when he very much overshadowed this win for the US military, saying, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Then said, open the straight, you crazy bastard, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah.
Normal posts on Easter Sunday.
Obviously, this post was entirely deranged, offended basically almost everyone equally. The issue with him kind of hitting the roof in this crazy and deranged way was that there was pretty much no wiggle room for him to continue the negotiations in like a normal and sound way. But, you know, he found a way because on Tuesday, which was the day before his 48-hour time limit was up, he tweeted, and as you've read, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will. However, now that we have complete and total regime change where different, smarter and less radicalized minds prevail, maybe something revolutionarily wonderful can happen. Who knows?" A lot of people have argued that the threat to kill an entire civilization is genocidal.
He would argue that this was a negotiating
yes.
strategy. You know, I dialed it up to 11, 12, 13 in yes. order to make it clear to them that the ramifications of not speaking to me would be so serious. Whether or not it was a bluff, we'll never know because they ended up negotiating.
They did.
And Trump would potentially just argue that, you know, oh, I was never going to really do that. I didn't mean that I was going to destroy Iranian civilization. It was part of the art of the deal. Chapter 3, just threaten...
Threaten to kill everyone.
Yeah, threaten to kill everybody.
Yeah.
I'm sure I read that in Art of the Deal.
Fortunately for the people of Iran, never came to that because Iran said they were willing to come to the table. Mm. So on Wednesday morning, the 8th of April, this is 90 minutes before the deadline that Trump had set, he agrees to suspend attacks on Iran for 2 weeks. Israel also agrees to the ceasefire. Iran's foreign minister agrees to stop defensive operations and promises safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. And they announce that these peace talks will begin. Trump posts on Truth Social, "Subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, immediate and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz, I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks. We received a 10-point proposal from Iran and believe it is a workable basis on which to negotiate." He then said that the 2-week military pause would allow agreements to be finalized and that the military conflict is close to being resolved. Now, this 10-point plan hasn't been officially confirmed by the US, but Iranian state broadcasters have claimed they wanted a complete cessation of the war on Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen, and a complete and permanent cessation on the war in Iran with no time limit, a reopening of the strait, full payment of compensation for the reconstruction costs to Iran, a commitment to lifting sanctions, and Iran would fully commit to not seeking possession of any nuclear weapons. The immediate ceasefire would take effect on all fronts immediately upon the approval of the above conditions. Obviously, this is just their first offer, and it was always unlikely from the very beginning that this was going to be approved, but at least it was a starting point for negotiations. However, the negotiations never started because later the same day, Israel launched 100 strikes across Lebanon in 10 minutes, which was one of the largest mass killings in the country since the end of the civil war in 1990. Now, Israel continues to insist that it was targeting Hezbollah in these strikes, but the death toll shows civilians are repeatedly bearing the brunt of their aggression across the country. Many of the targets were in Beirut and other areas that are well outside of the south, which is the area that the IDF asserts is a Hezbollah stronghold. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisted the ceasefire between the US and Iran did not include the war with Lebanon, while J.D. Vance asserts that the whole thing was a misunderstanding and he wanted to continue with the ceasefire negotiations, which brings us, I guess, to April 12th, this last weekend. Senior officials from the US, including J.D. Vance, and officials from Iran met in Islamabad in Pakistan.
Right. And J.D. Vance, I mean, not necessarily publicly, but according to reporting from behind the scenes, has been the guy basically trying to prevent any of this from happening.
Yes, exactly.
He certainly wasn't on board.
Yeah, he hasn't been on board publicly at all, and he's been working very hard behind the scenes to kind of get all of these countries to come to the table. J.D. Vance with an American delegation and an Iranian delegation meet in Islamabad in Pakistan over the weekend. And then on Sunday evening, J.D. Vance basically releases a statement online saying that after a marathon 21 hours of talks, it's falling apart and he will be returning to the US without having reached a deal.
Yes. And at this point, Brent crude futures go up 8%. And the ASX drops, and presumably we're going to see markets dropping around the world as it becomes clear that the Strait of Hormuz is not open.
No.
Considering this is what I woke up to this morning, the news that now not only is Iran blocking the Strait, but also Trump is.
Yeah. J.D. Vance, he blames the failure of the negotiations on Iran's refusal to abandon their nuclear weapons program. The Iranian delegates claimed that Washington needs to do more to win their trust and that they kind of had too many points that they needed Iran to sign on to, and Iran just basically wasn't willing to come to the table on those things. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump then came out and told reporters outside the White House that it made, quote, no difference to him if a deal was reached with Iran. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what happens, we win, he said. Whether we make a deal or not, it makes no difference to me, which is weird because it obviously makes a huge difference to him. And he clearly, for the last month, has been caring very much about the Strait being opened. Then he decides to basically move, effective immediately, the United States Navy will begin blockading any ship that tries to enter or leave the Strait of Hormuz, which is where we're at now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rightio.
Yeah.
Now, we've got some questions from people. What have we got?
Our first question is from David Kinden, who says, let me get this straight. Trump is unhappy that Iran has blocked the Straits. So unhappy that he intends to block them himself. Is that correct?
Yep. Next. No, I mean,
yes, that's correct.
Yeah, it is correct. But I mean, look, it is not as nonsensical as you might, you know, imagine. You know, Donald Trump is unhappy about a blockade of the Straits. And so he's responding to that with his own blockade. How does that make any sense? Well, basically, Iran hadn't totally blockaded the Strait. Iran had said only ships that we say are okay to go through can go through the Strait. Only oil exports from the Persian Gulf that we approve of and oil exports from Iran's own ports, we will be the gatekeeper and we will decide who gets in and out. And Donald Trump is basically saying, well, no, either everyone gets to use the Strait or nobody does, and you can't use your own control of the Strait to benefit. Basically, Iran would be able to export at least some of its oil at the extraordinarily high oil prices and make a lot of money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the theory behind why Donald Trump would blockade an already existing blockade, because he doesn't like the first blockade.
Yes, which kind of leads to the next question from Mish, who says, my understanding is that Chinese flag flying tankers have transited the Strait already and there are more to come. US plans to blockade these tankers in international waters. How will they board them and how do they expect China to respond, or haven't they thought that far ahead? So China, as you say, is one of the countries that has been allowed to have a kind of limited supply of oil coming through. I mean, I guess we'll see how this blockade from the US goes, but yes, technically it means that China's ships could be blocked from coming through the Strait as well.
Yeah. The end of Mish's question there is, or haven't they thought that far ahead? Probably not.
Unlikely.
Yeah. But look, basically, all of this is in some sense symbolic, basically. Iran isn't going out and sinking dozens of tankers that are trying to go through. They're saying, we'll sink you if you try and go through, and therefore nobody's trying to go through. And similarly, if the US says, we will prevent you from going through, they're hoping that nobody will attempt to. But, you know, whether that's going to be the case or not, I'm just pulling up a map right now of the Strait of Hormuz. Very little traffic going through in terms of people who have their tracking beacon on. It's interesting, though, if you open up a map of the Strait and you hover over some of the ships that are sort of transiting through, you can see what data they're sending out. And some of the data that they send out, of course, is their own name, the ship's own name. But they also give their destination. And some of the ships are changing the name of their destination to try and basically say who they are. For example, at the moment, there is a ship called the Aurora, which is transiting up close to Iran at the moment. And it's listed its destination as Indian crew, basically to try and say, we're Indian on there. You don't want to mess with us. We're Indian. Mm. But yeah, no, I mean, it's going to be extremely interesting. If the Americans board a Chinese flagged vessel while it's going through the Strait of Hormuz, that will be the biggest thing that we talk about for that week. And I don't think the Chinese would be very happy about it.
No.
Crucially, there are other important waterways around the world, including the South China Sea, which China may decide that they have a bit of an interest in boarding some ships that are going through the South China Sea, which would not be particularly in our interest as a country that exports a large amount of our stuff through the South China Sea. So it could get very interesting very fast. We just kind of have to hope that doesn't come to that.
Yeah, no doubt it will be changed again tomorrow morning when we wake up.
Yes, probably.
Our next question is from Zoe.
Hi, this is Zoe from Sydney. I was wondering whether the oil-producing countries are developing other ways to move the oil out of the region that don't rely on the Strait of Hormuz, and if so, how long that will take?
Well, we actually did an entire episode about the efforts to build alternative ways to get commodities out of the Middle East.
Yeah, we did. And there is a pipeline that Saudi Arabia is currently running at kind of full capacity. Those pipelines were built during the 1980s in response to, you know, previous instability in the Strait, which we talked about in our episode. But one of the interesting things we didn't talk about is they built them really fast. Authoritarian regimes can really get stuff done if they really, really want to. So, you know, potentially, if they decide to go down that route, then potentially you could have another couple of pipelines bypassing the Strait of Hormuz in a couple of years' time. But I think what's more likely to happen is countries are just going to take a long, hard look at their reliance on fossil fuels and imported fossil fuels in particular. I mean, we're already seeing the Australian government talking about the fact that this is highlighting the need for a shift to renewables. I saw plenty of people at the campsite showing up in their electric cars looking really smug, and I think that it's probably going to push more and more people to just finding ways to decrease their reliance on this kind of fuel. Of course, the one thing that we haven't really solved is how we're going to replace diesel fuel for freight transport, basically. All the ships that transport everything around the world, they all run on oil, although I do seem to recall that we did once have wind-powered ships at some point in the past.
Yeah.
But in terms of trucks and diesel trains and that kind of thing, we don't really have a short-term or medium-term or really long-term plan for replacing all of those. And that's why we're currently seeing the price of diesel massively outstrip the price of other forms of fuel, particularly petrol.
Yes. A neighbour of ours has one of those very large truck-style cars, and a tank of diesel now costs them $480 to fill up the car.
Whoa!
Our next question is from Is Greco, who asks, I was keen for your analysis on why Australia hasn't enacted fuel demand restrictions like we've seen through Southeast Asia and recommended by the International Energy Agency. For example, working from home mandates or restricted car use. Are we scared to push out these kinds of rules after COVID? Do we just have more reserves and so are willing to gamble on a quick resolution? Or is it just rich country privilege?
I think it's just rich country privilege.
I think so too.
A lot of Australians will be struggling, but if you think about much poorer countries than Australia, there are very, very large numbers of people that are really struggling to afford energy. And the government really does need to step in those cases, and that's what we're seeing around parts of Asia. In Pakistan, where the peace talks were underway, we've been discussing that their fuel reserves are getting dangerously low, and a big part of their economy is reliant on natural gas imports, primarily liquid natural gas imports that come out of the Persian Gulf, and they're not getting those. And that's causing massive concerns for them. One of the things Pakistan has done is they've ordered the closure of all markets at 8 p.m. They have ordered schools closed. They've ordered work from home. They've instigated free public transport, which is, you know, we're seeing in lots of places around the world, including in Australia. But they've got even more serious measures in Lahore, which is the second largest city in Pakistan and has a population of over 14 million people. The gas company that supplies Lahore is basically turning off the gas for most of the day. They are only supplying gas in the evening and in the morning for people to cook breakfast and dinner. It's only available during those peak times in order to conserve gas and try and push out the date where they're going to run out. They have secured enough fuel for April, but May is extremely questionable. So this situation could become exponentially worse in countries like Pakistan, which is potentially why Pakistan was so keen to get involved in the peace process.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to be talking about the gas market and Australia's role in it in our Thursday episode coming out in a couple of days. So, Cara, I better get back to writing that episode that's about gas.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm really happy with this one. It's a really interesting episode. I mean, it's not going to be a feel-good episode, but it's going to be an interesting one. I think it's going to open a lot of eyes about Australia's position in the global energy market, because one might be asking, why is it that when energy prices are skyrocketing, why aren't we celebrating as a massive energy supplier? Why isn't a big amount of this money going into Australia's government coffers? We'll get into that in our Thursday episode.
I want to also shout out to the real If You're Listening heads. This may be the episode that once, I think like 9 months ago, we said we were, this is Japan Gas, a rebrand of Japan Gas.
This is Japan Gas, yes.
So those of you who are listening who thought the Japan Gas was a big conspiracy that was pulled from air, this is a refreshed version of Japan Gas.
This is it.
Japan Gas.
Out on Thursday, pending something else happening that knocks Japan Gas off the schedule again. See you then, Cara.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.